You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Nick Redman. We are currently recording in Memphis, Tennessee. The temperature outside is about 68 degrees. I'm here with my good buddy, Alan. And we're going to talk about music, play some music, and hopefully stay out of trouble.
Yeah, man.
All right. This song, wrote a couple of days ago, called Ocarina. And I was talking, you was doing the walking. And I suppose that's how I was left behind. And in the story, one may still adore me. I can better read the last line. And in a weird kind of way, I loved you every day in my own kind of way. You know I never lied. And Ocarina, man, girl, you should have seen her. Pretty as hell, and she waved goodbye.
Don't you leave me so far out.
you was doing the walking. I suppose that's how I was left behind.
Yes, sir.
Man.
Oh, man.
Sounds like we're on an old ship.
Yeah, man. Brother, I really appreciate you taking the time, man.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And so, just, they'll see the video of you playing, they'll be able to look at it. And if you don't mind, share that story again about this old guitar you're playing on.
Well, I got this from, I don't know how many hands it's actually passed through, but the legend of this guitar is that Chris Bell got in an argument with Andy Hummel. Both of these were members of a band from Memphis called Big Star. And, Chris had supposedly gotten mad. And I'm sure, I don't know what date, but I'm sure it was in the late 60s or early 70s. Had gotten mad at the bass player and broke his bass in half.
Jeez.
And so to retaliate, Andy Hummel went to Chris's job while he was working and in the trunk, popped his trunk, found his beloved classical guitar, took a screwdriver and stabbed it right in there, right through the body. And so in the video, I guess you'll see that screwdriver hole right in the top next to the neck. Now, as the legend further goes, one of Big Star's more well-known songs called 13 was written on this guitar. And this is, of course, according to Jody Stevens, who was the drummer of the band. So, you know, I don't know how these stories get started, but the inside of the guitar is handwritten, the date that it was made, and that is 1964. So,
yeah,
it all lines up in a way, you know.
Yeah. You said Miami, right?
Yeah, it's built in Miami. How did it get up here? Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? That's Rocky Balboa that's crawling around on the table right now.
Right. Got a little cat action.
Yeah. Maine Coon thinks he's a dog. See, he's got a personality disorder.
Oh, man. He's checking everything out.
Yeah, he's famous around here. You know, he's famous on the block. I guess he's trying to expand his horizons.
Yeah, man. So, man, just growing up, when did you get into music and I guess the influence behind that? Was it in the home or how did that start for you?
Well, how many answers to start out like that? Well,
I'm telling you.
Many. As far as my mother's side, I mean, it depends on how far back you want to go. My great-grandfather, Saul, he played violin, and which is weird because he had my hands, which are big fat fingers.
Mm-hmm.
So weird that he would play that instrument, you know. But his wife was actually a pianist, and they would travel around, and she would play for the silent movies. And so at that time, you wouldn't have any sheet music for a silent movie. You would go in, you would, you know, have a place you were supposed to perform, a venue, and you'd go in, and the only thing they would give you is excited, scared.
Liner notes, yeah.
Just liner notes, and you had to improv the entire performance. I'm sure some of it would never be ever heard again, you know, but you can imagine how cool that must have been as an audience member compared to how it is now. You know, you show up, and this person just free flows, they're watching this silent movie and playing at the same time and playing what comes
to the emotion.
To the emotion and on the spot, you know. So,
and they're carrying all the weight. It's a silent movie, and so that music is going to fuel the audience.
That's it. That's the only thing you could hear. And so that's how she made her living, and he played in small troops as well. But that got carried on to my grandparents on my mother's side, and they were both musicians by trade.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were, one was a trombone player in big bands, a lot of the jazz bands, traveling. union members. She was a cello player. And okay. So their big brushes with fame, I think, weren't necessarily them necessarily becoming famous, but playing next to people who did. You know, my grandmother was hired to play with the Bee Gees on tour. Couldn't stand their music, but she was, you know, she's a concert trained, you know, but she said that actually the Brothers Gibb were actually very well trained in theory, and she actually had nothing but compliments about them.
Wow.
So I just try to picture my grandmother playing on Staying Alive.
Hi.
You know, yeah, I just can't, I can't see, but you know, they weren't always, disco was something they ran with. It's like Garth Brooks going rock and roll. You know, he made his fame off of his country music. Well, same thing. Like they weren't always disco. They were soul. They were a soul band, mm-hmm. R&B. You know, and that's how they got famous. You know, songs like, oh gosh, wow, I'm blanking now. But one of their big songs, oh help me out, Alan. It's the one that. Susan Marshall used to play this song at Neil's every other week, and man, she could play this song. So if there was only we had a device,
I'm telling you,
that could look up this.
Where is this technology?
This technology,
Alexa.
Alexa, where are you? But his big claim to fame was he played next to John Williams in the Army. Now John Williams would go on to. He was a trumpet player at the mm-hmm. time, but my grandfather knew him as a kind of amateur composer and trumpet player, played right next to him in the band. Well, John Williams would go on to play, he would compose film scores for Star Wars, Jurassic Park,
legendary soundtracks.
Pretty legendary sound. To Love Somebody. That's the Bee Gees song. To Love Somebody.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's got
you
a cover
don't
of that.
Know
yeah.
what? That's not disco. That's R&B. No. It's R&B. It's 70s R&B.
And so, but she wasn't a fan of the music, but she had high.
No, she didn't have. She wasn't a fan of the music. They were strictly jazz, big band, and 100% classically trained and. Anytime you'd go over to their house, that's what you were going to hear is classical music. And they knew it. They knew it all. They knew it like we know the Beatles catalog. Yeah. They knew every single thing there was to know about it. He wrote his dissertation on Hungarian classical music.
Wow. You know.
But with that, you know, he was a hero of mine. But I don't think I was necessarily set on a road to play music. I had a lot of energy as a kid, and I was put in gymnastics pretty early on, and that turned into a competitive. So, before I started touring in bands, I guess I was touring on a boys' team, mm-hmm. Going from city to city competing in gymnastics, and that lasted until I was about 15. I injured myself, and I wouldn't have ever been able to. I was trying to get to an Olympic level. But I wouldn't have ever been able to make it with the injury that I had. So I kind of started teaching for a while
mm-hmm.
and looking for something else to do, you know, because I loved gymnastics. So it was my life up until that point.
Sure.
And, I mean, I remember going to school and I couldn't take tests because my hands were bandaged from, you know, the skin being ripped off of them in eighth grade, you know. I got sent to the principal's office for that. Mr. Redmond is refusing to take his test, and I couldn't hold a pencil.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Right.
What do you want me to do?
And what do you want me to do?
Prick
you know?
My finger?
So, yeah, right. I'll take the test, but it's going to be contagious. You know, the thing is I've ended up bored. Always saw my dad had a guitar.
Yeah.
So all that music was on my mother's side, right?
Yeah.
But she didn't play an instrument. She doesn't sing. She doesn't. She likes. I mean, let's see. Her preferences in music aren't. She doesn't. She likes music, but you don't hear her talk about it much. You know. My dad was no music on his side of the family.
Yeah.
But he taught himself to play guitar. So he had a guitar in the closet. Always did. Kind of put it away while we were growing up. And I noticed that once I started asking about the guitar, he started kind of like, his interest, you know.
It re-peaked?
Yeah, like kind of, he started getting back into it. And so he was like relearning the guitar and showing me at the same time everything he knew.
That's perfect.
Know? And I would...
How old were you at this point?
I was probably 15 years old, 14, okay. 15 years old. And maybe 16. I honestly, that's getting longer and longer ago, but it started to be kind of a thing that my dad and I just, you know, really bonded over. And
what were some of the first songs, man, that y'all
Well, he told me right off the bat, he said, if you can't... Well, he used to play this game with me, and I guess he knew me better than I knew myself as far as getting me to... getting that wandering mind to stay in one place. He would say, okay, well, if you don't learn this song, you don't know how to play guitar. So you have to be able to play this song,
yeah.
Then you can say you're a guitar player. First time he did that was with a song called Blackbird by the Beatles.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know.
Yeah, it's all up and down the neck.
Blackbird. You know, it's all over the place. But I must have tore my hair out trying to figure out how to play that song. And eventually I got close, and I played it for him, and he goes, that's really good. That's really good. However, if you don't know how to play this next song, then you don't know how to play the guitar.
Yeah, raise
the stakes.
And this went on.
And later I found out he was just kind of, whatever song he wanted me to learn how to play so he could sing or play to it, that's what he was doing.
Yeah.
So maybe he didn't know as much as, you know, maybe he didn't have a plan after all, but it worked.
Yeah.
And it got me to learn all of this music that I never would have known about. The Beatles music, classic rock music, you know, 60s, 70s music that would shape my view on music other than what was in front of me at the time, you know. So I grew up hearing nothing but classical from my grandparents, mm-hmm. and just being preached opera and classical.
Sure.
And then my dad starts hitting me with rock and roll, rock and roll, rock and roll. But then what was in front of me at that period of time was bands like the Smashing Pumpkins. You know? Mm-hmm. So I'm like staring at all these different, wildly different styles of music. And they're all very important to me, and very, you know, the alternative was the more rebellious teenager mm-hmm. side. The classic rock was, man, I love this music, but I love it mostly because my dad loves it, and, you know, and then, of course, the classical music, it was just always a part of my life. It was just kind of like, well, that's there, like table salt and pepper, you know, it's just there, you know.
When discovering Smashing Pumpkins, man, and, like, starting to do covers, did you get addicted to the Billy Corgan chords? Like, you know, remember Silver Sun Pickups? They had that song called Lazy
yeah.
Eye.
And oh, yeah. Was like, total ripoff.
I was like, that...
That is the Smashing Pumpkins, yeah. You know? He even kind of sounds like them, you know?
Yeah.
But, sure, yeah. And gosh, you know, to this day, I got to say, their music and was such a huge influence. That and Metallica.
Yeah.
Metallica was, like... perfect for me because it was a combination of classical music and alternate rock and roll, you know.
Sure.
It was just, you know, their first three records were with Cliff Burton on them. You know, he was classically trained, mm-hmm. and they taught, he, you know, they'll be the first to tell you in interviews that Cliff Burton was the mastermind behind those epic. You know, they weren't just songs. They had the form of classical music.
Right.
You know, there were movements within those songs, and you know, some of them were just instrumental pieces. You know, and it was like I had died and gone to heaven. You know, I'm like, oh,
yeah.
So naturally, I respected them so much. I followed them throughout their whole career. Went and saw them play three times. Although my first concert was the Smashing Pumpkins.
Okay.
So. It was at the Pyramid when back when it wasn't a Bass Pro Shop, it was a concert venue here in Memphis. And for anyone who doesn't know what the pyramid is, it is literally
pyramid.
A pyramid.
And it's Bass Pro Shop.
Yeah,
you know.
Because apparently there's a Memphis, Egypt. Why that has anything to do with Memphis, Tennessee, I don't know. You know, but I'm glad it's there.
Yeah.
But I remember my dad taught me, or took me to see that, and consequently, that's when I smelled pot for the very first time, was that night. And I said, man, what is that smell? It didn't smell good or bad. It just smelled
funky.
Like, it's something like, you know, you never smelled anything like that, but it lingers with you. You know, it you don't forget it. You know, you don't forget that smell. And I don't know, it had a very curious, you know, it leaves a curious impression in your mind. You know, like, what is, because I knew what it was from, you know, this is pre-internet, guys. Yeah. So, showing my age a little, but you couldn't go on the internet and research, like, what was that I smell at the concert? You know, it was word of mouth. Okay. And everything was word of mouth. So, it was all drugs and alcohol at that period of time. They traveled more instead of, like, seeing someone on Instagram do it. They were legend. They were of legend, of myth.
Oh yeah,
you know, and I think that probably had a lot to do with kids and their first exposure to those kinds of things. You know, whereas now it's totally different. You know,
it really was urban, man. Cause I remember back in my early pothead days, and hell, we were in Memphis, and we come up here for one of the Bill Street Music Festivals, and the people that we were staying with, they was like, y'all ever done a dry grav? And it's like, we do water gravs. Mm-hmm. And they was like, no, you take a bread bag and you fill it up with smoke. And I was like, what is this madness?
I tell you what.
And then, like, we started trading, like, ways we did it.
Yeah. Potheads are the most creative, inventive people, but only for smoking pot.
Yeah. Nowhere else. Yeah. Although I do believe that they're making fast food menus now.
I would agree. Yeah.
Burger, I mean, King's got a taco.
if you took a drug user's inventiveness and applied it to, you know, if you told someone, I'm going to probably get in trouble for saying this, but if you told someone addicted to crack, like, I'll give you a crack rock if you cure cancer, probably be done within 24 hours.
I bet so.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, or the way to get your next hit. This obstacle is in your way. They would solve it.
Yeah,
you know, and
it's a crazy inspirational thing. But I saw it the other day. It was like, I've never heard a crackhead or, you know, a drug addict say, "I don't have any cash. Guess I won't get high today." They find a way.
They find a way. You know, and this could go on for their entire lives.
Yeah.
So, again, there's some serious brain power in there. It's just pointed in
the wrong direction.
Questionably the wrong direction. Yeah. That's a whole other topic for me. You know, I struggle with that one. Because I think drugs and alcohol, that's all a choice. You know, and it's not the only person to judge someone for what they do with their time, I think, is God. You know, you can't say that someone over here is, you're doing better than them or worse, you know. Because it's really, you know, it's just subjective. It's their life. You know?
Yeah.
Now, if they're hurting other people, it's easier to pass judgment. But, you know, one of the first rules, God says don't judge. You know, it's, you just don't have the equipment to do it with.
No.
You know?
We're all coming from different lenses. You don't know how they got on it. Cause
no idea.
It could have been a car accident, and now they're stuck on pain medication, but now it's heroin because they got off the pain meds.
Man, they could have had their ass kicked every single day of their life growing up.
Yeah.
And
that's how
somehow,
they
do it. And somehow they dealt with it. So it's just impossible to say no, all drugs are bad. Now, you know, obviously they have the potential to ruin people's lives, and that's bad because it's bad for them, you know. But how does that affect, you know, how does that affect you, and how much pain would they be in without them, you know? it's just entirely too broad of a subject to for one human being to be informed on, you know.
Absolutely.
I just, and let's be honest, you know, when you got the president saying, oh, I tried it, but I didn't inhale, well, come on.
Yeah.
There's, you know, I just don't think that, they also say curiosity killed the cat, and it did, you know. Not my cat.
Not yet.
Not yet. No, he's eight and he's very curious. And
it's a dog coon, though.
Yeah, but he's a dog cat. Yeah, but I don't know how we got on this topic.
It just rolls, man. Yeah. It just happens. Yeah. Rabbit holes.
So say no to drugs. Yeah. You know.
We read a Smashing.
But I don't judge you if you don't.
Yeah. Smashing Pumpkins.
Smashing Pumpkins. Pot, man. Now later, my dad would take me to another concert. Tom Petty, and
oh, man.
From what I understand after the fact, the security officers were instructed not to arrest anyone inside the premises for smoking pot that night. At least that's what you would have thought, because my look.
Just a cloud of smoke.
Just next to me, in front of me, behind me, and I'm 15 years old, and I'm just going, what is going on, yeah. You know? So consequently, you know, you find yourself just thrust into the world of rock and roll, which is one of curiosity and myth, you know, and it's just larger than life. And I think that's a part of segueing into the original question of how do you get into music? Well, you throw in all that stuff happening, and I guess I just kind of forgot about teaching gymnastics, and I said, man, I like rock and roll.
Yeah.
I like music. You know,
that's what I want.
That's what I want to do. It just looks so shiny, and you know. But that again would be the next 20 years of my life finding out a much different side of it. You know, a much sure. different side. And I'm glad for every step of the way, but it is not. It is far from what it appears to be on the surface,
mm-hmm.
good or bad. It's not what it looks like on the surface. You know, I can remember going to see bands that weren't real famous yet,
mm-hmm.
and see them roll in, you know, later in my 20s, and I'd see them rolling in their tour vans and trailers, and I'd go, "They're living like that." That to me looks like the most amazing lifestyle. They're the coolest people in the world. They must be having the time of their lives. Well, later down the road, when I would tour with Star Mycy for 6 years, yeah, there is that.
Loadouts are fun, right?
Yeah, I mean, I remember helping these guys back in the day, like, load their equipment, because I thought it was fun, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then now, you know, you're the one doing it, and you've got to do it. It becomes more of a job than it does fun, you know? But honestly, Star Mycy, we had the best time on the road, and we made the most of it. I mean, heck, I met my soon-to-be wife because of Star Mycy touring. She's from Montreal.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, and I'll say this, just to say about the fun that y'all had is, like, still to this day, the people who caught, you know, one of the shows y'all came to Columbus and do, like, that is still one of the main memories that they have. Is like, I'll never forget that show.
Wow. Well, we won't either, you know, because we were having, if it looked like we were having a good time, it's because we were.
Yeah. Yeah. So I stayed at a buddy's house last night. He's one of the guys that caught the show. It was, I don't know how many times y'all played at the Princess. Was it twice?
Oh, no. We probably played there. Now, they call me Nick, check your facts, Redmond.
Okay.
I'm going to say we played there 5 times.
Okay.
It could have very well been twice.
Okay. Like, I don't know.
But you know what I mean?
Like, he called it, I guess maybe the second time y'all went, he was invited out, and he's still, like, when I told him I was coming up to do this, he's like, dude, he's like, that show was dope. He said, it may be the best show I've ever been to, and I've been to a lot of shows since then.
Well, man, we appreciate hearing stuff like that.
Yeah,
that,
man.
It makes it worth it in a whole different way, you know.
I mean, just some of the things that y'all done over the years for the music videos, man. It was, you had the pirate. That was a lot of fun. And what y'all did on the trolley.
Oh, yeah.
That's, and the I Can't Wait video.
Oh, man, that was fun. Getting slapped. Getting slapped a lot. You know, not just a little, but a lot. In fact, I'm pretty sure I got slapped the hardest.
It looked like it. Yeah,
yeah, it looked like she almost punched me, you know. But like I said, man, Star of Mycy was founded on relationships, and it was never a job, you know. It was always, you know, we were getting away with something, you know. We're hanging out. It doesn't matter where we would go, in what city, in what town, and in some cases what country, we always found ourselves. You know, you'd think, oh, this person, but we'd spread out and we'd do our own thing. But no, we always would find ourselves laughing and having fun in the corner, you know, having just spent 8 hours in the van together.
Yeah.
You know, you'd think we'd have to. But
no,
I mean, we really love being around each other, mm-hmm. and making music together. I mean, nobody really. I think it's great to be able to say that after 10 years with the band, because, I mean, it's still going, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Got a couple new records that are ready to be recorded.
That's awesome.
Which we'll probably start doing this next year here in Memphis. We've always left Memphis to record. It's the weird thing, you know?
Yeah.
It's very bizarre. We did one in Valdosta, Georgia. We did one in Mississippi. We had two in Mississippi.
What part?
Where was it? It was Oxford with a producer named Dennis Herring. And he did a Modest Mouse, Ben Folds.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think he's producing hip-hop now, but at the point, he did The Hives and, you know, a bunch of bands like that.
That's pretty prominent.
Yeah, he was doing really, really well.
And let's back this up a little bit. Before Star and Mycy, I guess before meeting Josh, you worked at Arden.
Mm-hmm.
And also, in his mind, it goes back to this with you and Jeremy when y'all were co-hosting the open mic for More Singer-Songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
And just take me back there. What was going on then? Like, I guess where you were in your music. Were you pretty focused on being a solo act? At that time?
No, I was doing it for fun. I was focusing on producing records. Okay. I was focusing on finding talent, and not just someone to record, but someone that I thought had a hit song. And I would convince them to come into the studio, and I'd record the song after hours, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would take the song to anyone that I knew that could sign them or get it out, you know. And I was doing this for free for a lot of local acts, you know. I won't name names, you know. But I was just running around for a few years trying to find the best of the best, you know. And that's how I met Josh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I met Josh through doing Neil's thing, but that was something I was doing for fun. You know, just an outlet to play music. But my focus was engineering and producing records at that point.
Okay.
And
how'd you get connected with them? Did you go to school for it?
Well, actually, I walked in there one day and said, I want to work here. And they're like, well, you got to go to school and get a degree. And I said, okay, I'll be back. So I went and did that. And I literally came back and said, okay, I'm back. And they said, okay, you're hired.
Worked out pretty good.
Yeah, it worked out all right at the time, you know. But so Jeremy was someone that I was kind of recording and courting, I guess you could say, as far as just convincing him, like, you know, hey, he had different bands at the time. And I said, man, do something by yourself, you know, and maybe we can get you selling songs, you know, something like that. But really, it was just him, myself, Brandon McGovern, and Van Duren, who is also an amazing... I mean, they're all amazing. Mm-hmm. But Van goes back to the 70s as well, the era of Big Star, as far as his beginnings. Mm-hmm. And he just had a documentary made on him. But, you know, we're just sitting up... That's Memphis for you, you know? You have this huge generational span up on a stage for free every Wednesday night, you know, and you'd get, some nights you'd have a packed house, some nights you'd have 10 people, some nights you'd have one.
Yeah.
And we used to always have this thing where in the intermission we'd let anybody get up and play three songs and then we'd come back up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was known as, it was my favorite part of the night.
Someone trying to get known.
Yeah, and because it would always be a bizarre, I mean, sometimes I swear these people just picked up a guitar, you know. But their heart, you could see, like,
yeah.
The heart was what it was, you know. Mm-hmm. But sometimes that could drag on, you know. That's, of course, when you first start playing songs, a lot of times they'll go on for 7 minutes and intros that are for 2 minutes. And that's where a lot of these guys were, particularly they were, like, trying to play out and feel what it was like to play live. And so sometimes it wouldn't be very polished. A lot of times it wouldn't be very polished, but we offered that outlet as a way to... Because Richard, who was doing Neil's sound at the time, mm-hmm. and still does, he is the best sound guy in Memphis, Tennessee. And so for them to be able to go from playing in their bedroom and then to go play on his setup up there is amazing. Yep. Feeling. It's necessary to grow as an artist. Well, Josh was one of those bizarre acts that got up one night. And
don't purr for us.
Yeah, you gonna sing the song, Rocky? And he gets up there, and man, he was not like the others. I don't know how else to put it. He was not like what we were used to seeing.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was trying to impress this girl. And she knew him and was like, she introduced the two of us.
Yeah.
And, oh, well, Nick, you work at Ardent. You should record Josh. This is after he played the intermission. And I was thinking, you know. Yeah, well, you got a CD, you know, I was giving him the rundown. And in most situations, I guess I would have not listened to most of the CD because I knew that I would be questioned on it. And knew that I needed to, you know, see it through in case she asked me about it.
Mm-hmm.
I did. I went and listened to the whole CD at home, and it was this CD that was scrawled with his name on it. I don't even think there was a number on it. I think I had to get that from somebody. But it just said Joshua Andrew Cosby, and on it was 24 songs. I'll never forget this. 24 songs. Of him in his living room with dogs running around, like it's like someone hit a record on a recorder, yeah. You know. And he's on a 3-string banjo. And you would think, just from that description, like, well, that sounds awful. Alan, I'm telling you, it is one of the greatest CDs I've ever heard in my life. And these songs. The songs, man, were just... I went, oh, that's what I've been looking for.
Yeah, you've been bringing it.
Yeah, that's not what he played at Neil's that night. Nothing close to what he played at Neil's that night. I don't even know. I honestly don't even remember what he played at Neil's. It didn't resonate at that point, but that CD sure did.
Yeah.
And I spent the next month... I mean, I literally became a fan of those songs and knew them like the back of my hand before I ever got in touch with them.
Yeah.
I mean, how rare does that ever happen? You know how many people give you a CD when you're making records, you know?
Yeah.
And I got to say, 99% of them are good, but they're not great. and you just, it's so rare. And this is on a burnt Memorex CD with the known, with a, it looked like he was in a helicopter when he wrote his name.
Yeah.
Later found out that's because he's got nerve damage in his hands and his hand shakes when he writes, but it, you just can't make this stuff up, you know?
I'm telling you.
And so at the time I had a tape player and I said, well, tell you what, before we go and, you know, oh, let's go back. Getting in touch with Josh. He didn't have a phone. He had a rotary telephone in his house that never got answered. And so it would just ring and ring and ring and ring and ring. And honestly, I know he called me back, but it did take a month or two. I kept giving my number to his pothead roommate that would never deliver the message. And somehow it finally got through.
Yeah.
You know? And I mean, his roommate was kind of like it's kind of like Brad Pitt in True Romance, you know.
Yeah.
Just like. But we eventually got together, and I started recording on my little tape machine. That's the first time I made a recording of a song called "So Much Pain," and the percussion was me, both of us in the hallway of my apartment at the time, which is all old Midtown apartment. We would just use a boot with our hand in it, and that would be the cadence to the song.
Uh-huh.
And it would, but it was the same tape machine that Black Keys used to make their first two records.
I know what you're talking about.
An old Tascam 388.
Mm-hmm.
And so
one down thing in
led
basement.
One thing led to another, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, I guess I started out producing the band, and I was never asked to join. I just never left.
Yeah.
They needed guitar work. I didn't think they did, but the record label did.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was, I kind of had Josh, I used to describe the early Star Micey when I was selling it as the Violent Femmes meets Michael Jackson. And I'm like, it's perfect. You know, it has the pop sensibility of Michael Jackson and the quirky and indiness of the Violent Femmes and the lyrics. They had the depth of the Violent Femmes. And I still think that was, those songs were great, you know. But in the end, their label wanted something that was pure 3.5 minute radio, AAA radio ready, and that's what we gave them. And mm-hmm. so we took Josh's songs, and we made the first Star Micey record. And I put guitar on every one of the songs. Their drummer quit in the middle of making that record. He agreed to finish it, but we actually had Paul Taylor come and do a song. We had Jody Stevens from Big Star come and play drums on a song. We kind of filled out the ones after he quit with different guests.
Mm-hmm.
And we put that thing out and on our label and started touring. And then soon after that, that's when the drummer quit, that's when we started playing drums with our feet. And that went on for over a year.
Yeah. Until Jeremy, right?
Until Jeremy, yeah. But I mean, I played the cymbal with my foot. They played and played guitar and sang. And Josh played kick drum with his foot, played guitar and sang.
Yeah.
And Jeff played bass and hi-hat and sang. So the mouths were working, the bodies were working, and the feet were working, you know. And I remember one time telling some guy, goes, man, you guys, that is really cool to watch, but you are working way too hard. And he's right, man. We would get done with those shows dripping in sweat.
Yeah.
I remember when Jeremy started playing with us, it was like, it seemed too easy. You know what I mean? Like, so all I gotta do is play guitar. Like, what do I do to this? You know, there's so much other stuff I'm used to doing, you know. And each one of us is kind of going,
is that where throwing the gymnastics in came from? A little more free space?
Yeah, that's when we started doing backflips off the stage and throwing confetti, and
turned into this
We wanted it to be as the live performance to be just as explosive as we could make it on a budget, you know. So I mean, I think we even tried fire one time. Yeah, we told the Levitt Shell that we wanted to shoot off fireworks in the middle of our set, and they told us no. But with anything within reason, we would build these elaborate stage. I mean, we're talking with a drill and some 2x4s and cardboard would layer over the top of it and screw the cardboard images in and create these lavish set designs. And the show was just as important as the music, and one did not sacrifice over the other. You know, like, we worked real hard on that music, but then we also worked real hard on the show. Mm-hmm. You know, and at a certain point we were playing so many shows that we couldn't possibly. We tried. When we first toured, we carried the set around with us, and we would build it in the venues. It was nuts. Like, we were nuts. We were crazy. Some would even say not that smart, you know. But we'd spend an hour and a half setting up the show before we would play for two people. So a lot of people called us the hardest working band in Tennessee at the time. But I'm gonna tell you this: I'm not so sure that's what you want to be called. That means that you look like you're working too hard.
Yeah.
And you should work hard, but you should, you know, work smart too.
Yeah.
We weren't working smart, not in the beginning. We were working on a sheer heart, you know, the passion of something, the heart of something. That's what fueled us.
I think it was always visible, man. Like, it goes back to some of those live recordings that y'all had done in the studio with so much pain and, I'm drawing a blank, man. Enough? No, not enough. Everything.
Everything.
Yeah. With that said, man, like, you could see just sparks. It seemed like y'all were just setting each other off while y'all were having that time.
Man, I appreciate you saying that, because we sure were having a good time. Well, not recording that song, but writing it.
Yeah.
And playing it, you know. But the recording process of that record was a little less to be desired, you know. But it was like what you hear, you know, locked in a studio, not allowed to leave.
Till
you finish, you know. Not the spontaneous party that it looks like on TV.
Yeah.
You know. So, I mean, obviously we tried our very best, but we were just, you know, the late John Hampton, you know, just a very well-known and very well-accomplished producer, engineer from Ardent. He always called us liquid concrete. I love that. It's not good, not bad. It's not, you haven't, I mean, it's been poured, but it hadn't set.
It ain't set.
You know. And when we would hire producers, you know, I had to kind of leave that job behind once I joined them, because it needed to be subjective. I didn't feel like I needed to have that much influence over the band, yeah. You know. And I didn't want to. I wanted to just kind of sink back into the artist role,
yeah.
Which is what I started out doing, mm-hmm. You know. But I walked away from it, and then I was glad to be back, you know. So I kind of, it was a struggle. I remember trying to release control over everything, and it was hard to do, but it felt good to do it once it happened.
Yeah.
You know, I was so used to calculating every next move as their producer, and it's hard to, like, okay, well, let whatever happen. It's like, you know?
Yeah.
And they'll tell you, like, they probably didn't enjoy being around. I know Jeff didn't enjoy being in the band with me in the beginning, but we became best friends, yeah, over time. But that immediate relationship was, you know, who is this guy telling me where to put my bass and where to put my bass on stage and how things should look on stage? What are you talking about? I'll do whatever I want.
Right.
You know? And Josh would always say, "Well, Jeff, do you have a plan?" And he's like, "No, I'm just going to put it where I went." And he goes, "Well, Nick has a plan, so let's follow that plan." You know? But I don't know. I saw so much in them. Always have. Still do. I saw so much in them. My vision for that band was one that was not just touring, but was playing stadiums, you know. I still think that's what it is. I still think it belongs in a stadium, mm-hmm. that kind of music. It's just that sound, you know. Not every sound needs to be, you know, put out in that particular way. Some sounds are better in a small venue. Some sounds are better at festivals. You know, some sound. You ever notice, like, you know, some bands, they're huge, but then they play a festival and they sound.
It's not good.
Translate. Yeah. You know. And then some bands, you know, don't sound good in a small venue, but sound great, mm-hmm. in a stadium. And I just always thought Star of Mycy belonged. Their songs and their music was more of a stadium act, you know.
Mm-hmm. I'd agree with that, man, because I think at the beginning, y'all were ahead of your time with the music, with where it was at the time, especially when y'all were a three-piece before Jeremy, with, like, everybody doing different percussion. It was kind of like a Mumford & Son or a Lumineer thing, you know?
You know, we hear that a lot. We hear that a lot, but... You know, I remember when we were always kind of at that point, you know, right around the corner, you know, not far enough ahead to really claim first prize, but just, and didn't have the notoriety, even if we were, you know, but we reinvented ourselves so many times. Every time someone would, like, when we would be doing the foot percussion, then Mumford & Sons comes out and we go, "Oh crap, mm-hmm. they're doing exactly what we're doing right now, and they're getting famous for it." Well, we'd get bored and we'd throw the foot percussion away, mm-hmm. and we'd say, "Now we're rock and roll."
Yeah.
Or, "Now we're gonna be folk," you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And or when we were a six piece, you know, that's when we had a violin and an accordion player and we were playing gypsy style train beats and this huge party. I mean, it was like, it was just so many versions of the band and so many looks and styles. And that's what I enjoyed so much about Star of Mycy, was that journey of, you know, we were never sitting in one place too long. We were always like, "Oh, this is cool. Now let's move." And the ability to explore all of those musical styles, mm-hmm. from European bulk music, you know, to just 2-minute pop songs, to remix, you know, to electronic, to folk, to just banjos, just deep country music, and like whatever we wanted to do that day, mm-hmm. is what we did, you know.
So, like, over time with the songwriting, man, you or Josh would come to the table with a song and then everybody would put their part in, or would y'all co-write everything together, or how did that look like at the as y'all went along?
At first it was Josh. We played Josh's songs.
Mm-hmm.
And they encouraged me to start playing mine. And then it kind of became again, check my facts on this one. At some point, it became just Josh and I. I think in the beginning, it was Josh and I writing the songs together. Like, I just really loved. I mean, we wrote so many songs together. But later, I think it became, in the more recent years, it started to become, okay, well, this is a Josh song or this is a Nick song, you know. But in that kind of defined Star Micey, you know, it was the records, it's either Josh or Nick singing as far as whose song, depending on whose song it is. Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong, I would sing Josh songs and see how they sounded, and vice versa, and he would sing my songs, see how they sounded. We were completely, and so we would get Jeremy to sing the songs, you know, get Jeff to sing the songs, you know. Mm-hmm. Live, the big idea was that everyone would sing,
yeah.
and they do.
And it didn't matter if it was a Josh. It didn't matter. It was Star Micey song.
That was the big idea, but you know, and that's kind of where it remains today. Mm-hmm. You know, is our favorite thing to do is to have alternating verses. So I'd sing the first, or Josh sing the first. Exactly. That was we really latched on to that model of everyone having a verse that was their voice, and then when the choruses come, it's four-part harmony.
Mm-hmm. And man, like with that song, like even if like I was just getting familiar with the band, like when you share a verse or songs like that, after hearing previous songs, mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that's Nick. I can tell by the way he writes. I know that's Josh. That's the way he writes.
Yeah, I think,
and it like ties in your worldview, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd be like, well, I know whose lens we're looking through here.
Right.
And so it's interesting seeing, and then having a chorus, it just, it's right there in the middle.
Man, Josh and I, all of us. I mean, all of us have that chorus addiction. Yeah. We're addicted to the big.
Yeah,
chorus, you know, it's that's what I like to say. I think we're addicted to those. We love them.
Yeah,
we love hitting that big chorus, you know. But at the same time, I mean, you're right. You know, you're absolutely right. It's one of the things that attracts me to that band to this day is that. I don't know. I think maybe each one of us would have gotten bored if it was just one person and one person's lens, mm-hmm. the whole 10 years. I just don't think any of us... Maybe we all have too big of egos to... I don't know what it is, you know. But we thrive on being able to go through those lenses throughout a set. And... You know, maybe I didn't write anything that day or week, mm-hmm. you know, and Josh wrote two phenomenal songs. Well, there you go. That's what, you know, we never stopped.
Yeah.
We never stopped writing. We never stopped playing new songs. The sheer amount of music that hasn't been recorded but written, my biggest fear is that it doesn't get recorded, mm-hmm. and it gets forgotten about. Because, I mean, how many songs can you remember every part of, you know? We try to record cheap versions of them, you know, and keep up, but there was definitely a period of time where we were writing music faster than we could possibly
get it down,
you know.
I've had that happen, man, not to y'all's level, but like, just say I wrote a song 8 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and I myself forgot about it 5 years ago, and I go flip through the notebook and I find it, and I'd be like,
oh, yeah, man, I remember that being great, you know, I really liked
it's
that.
It's like a brand new song again.
Yeah. Yeah, my biggest fear is it would definitely be not having a record of it all.
Yeah.
And only, because right now we only probably have a record of, it's probably ambitious to say half. It's probably less, mm-hmm. you know. But we're all young. There's plenty of time to get this stuff recorded.
And so just...
But yeah.
Even apart from Star Micey is... Mm-hmm. You got Black Betty with Josh now.
Awesome.
And
awesome.
I can't wait for that to come out. Jeremy Stanfield's got his song.
Have you heard it? Have you heard Black Betty City?
He shared a couple of songs. So
it's fantastic. Yeah.
I've
heard the whole thing.
It's not out yet. Yeah.
No, but it's
fantastic. I've heard Alone, and I think he shared one other song off of it.
Is it the one that has the Nintendo 8-bit music?
I didn't
hear it. Wait, did you hear? It's great.
No, it was just great. Me and him sitting down and he played.
He had this guy.
No, I take that back. It was just Alone because he did so much pain. He did that.
Oh, it's great. He had a guy who composes in just 8-bit sound, which is like Nintendo music.
Yeah.
Composed the this score that he wrote to one of his songs. It's just great, man. I told him, I said, you need a whole album of just this. Because it's just that good.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about it that works, but it works. And but in true Josh fashion, he just did one of them and went on to the next thing.
Yeah.
You know. But the album is awesome. I love it.
And so, I mean, you obviously are right, and you just shared a song you just wrote a couple of days ago. Just as far as your solo project, as far as playing out, or is that kind of on hold right now for you, or what's that look like?
It's all very alive and well. It just, there are certain periods, you know, seasons. Music, yeah, there's, for sure. Music was a gigantic priority for me my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, whereas Star Mycy still, we still get together once a week and play, and we're still recording music, writing music, and accepting shows. You know, it's nothing is. You know, we made a pact a long time ago. We'll never stop. You know, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I write a song whenever I hear it in my head, and if I get a chance to record it, I'll record it and I'll put it out on the internet if I remember to do it. But in the meantime, you know, I'm about to get married, and there are focuses that I'm definitely attracted to as far as a priority in the immediate future. But as far as music goes, it's in my blood. It'll never go away. And I think all of us have proven that in the past 20 years, you know, all four members of Star Mycy. Star Mycy was, in short, a collection. It was four music lovers and four brothers that got together and had a really good time.
Mm-hmm.
And are still having a really good time, you know. But as individuals, like you said, there are certain things. When you play, when as the Star Mycy or any band's brand solidifies, there's some music that doesn't necessarily
belong,
mm-hmm. you know. And for Josh and Jeremy and Jeff, and myself, we've given those outlets a little more attention lately, and they deserve it, you know. All those songs deserve to be put out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because as a whole, Star Mycy, there is this entity that we filter music through. But there are songs that should also be heard from Jeremy and Josh and myself, and, you know, that should be heard as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're all giving that individual lens a little more attention, because when we get together, I mean, it's on.
Yeah.
You know, it's like getting in the seat of getting on the back of a horse you've been riding for 15 years. You know, it's,
you know what to do.
Kinda, you know what to do. Yeah. You know.
So,
you know, so.
yeah,
it's muscle memory.
Yeah.
For sure.
Brother, anything else to add or subtract?
When are you putting out a record, man?
That's something that I have been thinking about over the past year. And so, like, I've got probably right now about 15 songs.
That's more than enough for a record.
I really believe in.
That's three records.
Yeah, sure. And some of them are from an old band I had, the General Specific, and then 10 of them are what I've wrote since the General Specific's not a thing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just been trying to figure out how I want to record it. Like, do I want to go? Because I've done a studio before, and that was it was a good experience. It was a guy who was teaching me how to play guitar.
Yeah,
and I've done all the music that you heard on that album, with the exception of drums, because I couldn't play drums.
Wow.
And so I like that. I may go back with him, but I'd like to record it off what I got here.
Maybe. And you heard it here first, folks. With what you're doing, the way you're doing it and going and speaking with the musicians, you know, you might consider putting the skeleton together, and as you travel, having people fill out the parts, and you know, that was, you'd be very surprised at probably what comes from that, in a good way.
So what I had in mind for this was like one of the songs I've got. I don't know if we may run out of time, but I was going to run out there and get the guitar. And this is for the episode before this one.
Yeah.
It's called Taj. He's a drummer from Starkville. And I told him, I'm going to Memphis this weekend. He's like, are you going to play some music? And I was like, well, here's the thing. And this is what I'm thinking with my recording process is I literally just got this song. Like, I just wrote it down. I'm going to see if I can flesh it out. Yeah. I want to ask someone who's never heard it. Is it worth a crap? I mean, is there potential? What do you think, you know?
Well, let's do it.
And let's play it.
Let's do it.
Let me go get my guitar.
All right.
News and notes. This episode ended abruptly, didn't it? I would ask, if you hadn't done so already, that you would rate, review, like, subscribe, comment, follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. That's Porch Talk. And you can find us. It's the same logo as the podcast you just listened to. It's pretty intuitive there. You can find us there. So as I rushed out, after pressing stop on the recording to get my guitar out of the truck and to rush back in, and to play this, I lost confidence in this. I had just written that guitar piece 2 days before I went to Memphis, and I hadn't even written the words. I knew that I would be traveling through some meandering back roads in Alabama, up to 78, the corridor, up to Tupelo, and then eventually to Memphis, and that I would have everything I needed to write the song. And so I did, on a memo. But I didn't share it. I shared Georgia. That's a 2 or 3 year old song that I had written. But it was still a skeleton, just like this is. And you can hear that one on the latest episode. And Nick helped me flesh it out. So that version of Georgia is different than, if you've ever heard Georgia, you haven't heard that Georgia. And that was a one and done. I don't do mulligans here. I don't do redos. I don't give my guests redos. It's, I mean, what you did is what you did. So I've done the same for myself. And so the last episode, that was the new, but still not polished version of Georgia. But, yeah, that was cool. And so the recording process, and I'm excited to talk about it, I guess, as Nick brought it up with the album, is for, I guess, till end of spring of 2020, as we do this podcast, I'll carry my songs around and we'll begin to put some flesh on that bone. And then maybe by mid-2020 I'll be recording, and I'll invite those guests back to help me finish those songs, and we'll have a really cool project on our hands. How's that sound? But now, we gotta close. Nick is gonna close us out. And so you heard, if you follow us on Instagram or Facebook, the beginning of this. But here's the ending, and the recording flawed on me, so I don't have the beginning. But here's the break to the end. So thank y'all so much. Peace out. It's going now.
But I'm hoping, wishing everything will be fine. I'm hoping, not kissing everything goodbye. And I don't understand why I ate all day. every day. Wanna feel this way every day.
It's so new, it doesn't even have a name. yeah, whatever the name you guys want it to be, you go ahead and email Alan.
Thank you, man.
Or carrier pigeon. Thank you.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.